Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to, God damn it, the Mary Rose. When was the last time this happened? We have got our act together and assembled down the pub. Some of us, anyway. But there is a downside to this, isn't there, Chris? What is the downside to this? How long have you been in charge of scheduling?
About 4 weeks.
And what is the topic of tonight's debate?
Tonight is a very tough one. We have to decide who the greatest German is, which is difficult because the whole nation is great. So I don't know how we're going to do this.
Alina's giving you the wank sign, and rightly so. Kit's just put in the chat, Chris loves Goebbels.
Gerbils,
yeah, slang for something else. Holmes, presumably you're a font of wisdom about all things German.
I did do a little Googling because I thought this would start like Clive. I thought we were starting at 7, then we started at 8, so I had an hour. So I thought to add value, because I like to add value, I don't know that much. In fact, the only one I went in any depth for was the Brothers Grimm, because I thought they were going to be introduced, but they haven't been. And I ended up rereading my Rumpelstiltskin book, which I always used to find Rumpelstiltskin quite scary anyway. But I reread it and the plot is dreadful. So a bloke goes in front of the king and he's a bit scared. I don't know why he's in front of the king anyway, this Miller. And he says, my daughter can spin gold, which is a bit of an unusual reaction. And then she can spin gold out of straw. And then in the end, she gets put in a room full of straw every night. Can't do it. Gets in a bit of a state. A little chap called Rumpelstiltskin comes in. Spins the straw into gold. She keeps giving him stuff. Then she runs out of stuff to give him. And then he says, well, I'll carry on. But if you become queen, I will have your first child, unless you know my name. Which is a really weird plot when you think about it, isn't it?
Yeah. Kit's trying to modernise it in the chat using Prince Andrew, which is possibly even worse. Not lying. So what you're saying is it's a good job Kate had to work late because her pitch was shit.
Yeah, well, I thought it was quite good. You know, they've got, obviously, there's a massive cultural export of all these tales, although some of them I think were misappropriated by the looks of it. But yeah, but I don't know, if you reread the Ladybird books again, they're not as great as you thought they were back in 1979.
Indeed. Right. Who else? So Kit is here. He's already causing trouble. Chapman, what are you up to? How is Cornwall?
Exactly, Cornwall. So previously, I think I was in Thailand last time we had the Mary Rose.
God, quite possibly. I have vague recollections of you utterly shitted on £2 beer and just disappearing.
I mean, I was quite drunk. So much alcohol was drunk that I actually found myself emailing the Ronald Reagan Institute with gay porn titles for books involving Ronald Reagan as a pitch.
Who hasn't done that when they're shitted?
Come on. I was going to say, that didn't go down very well. Now I'm in Cornwall. I'm a lecturer at the University of Falmouth. If you want to learn about journalism or creative writing, I'm the person doing it. So please come along.
Excellent. This is the first time I've seen Kit sitting up on screen. I've seen him sitting up in real life, but normally he's lying down or doing something else. But
it's really weird. When you're in a hotel, there are so few seats. What you discover is that basically you're just existing on a bed. And now that I'm actually, you know, I've got a house, unbelievably, I'm living very nicely in Cornwall. It's really nice here. It's lovely. I've got a chair as well. I've got a desk and everything.
Adult in for the win from Kit. You've already heard from Chris, who's inflicted the Germans on us tonight, or the Germans. Chris?
Yes.
How is Medway?
I'm trying not to go outside. I've become really peculiar. I don't like going out and interacting with people. And I talk to myself a lot more now, which has a link to tonight, as I was walking in the countryside right out in the middle of nowhere, chatting away to myself, no one around for miles, walk straight into someone while I'm in mid-conversation in German to myself, because I'm mad.
Did you stop going outside because every time you did, your little ginger face got burnt?
the last 2 weeks, yeah, on and off.
Oh dear. We also have Clive with us. Hello, Clive.
Hello, Alex. Lovely to see you in the dark there.
Lovely to see you sitting in the dark. Where's your porno light tonight?
I forgot to charge it up. It's been so long since I had to use it.
Have you recovered from the Chelsea game?
What game? I've missed that. The season hasn't started yet.
Yeah, good, correct answer. And we've got Alina.
Evening.
Alina presumably hit the roof when she saw the topic of this debate.
Do you know what? When it's my turn, I'm going to tell my little story before I actually do my argument. So instead of doing it now, I will give you guys a little taster. So yes, I got very annoyed, but I've dealt with it and now we're moving on.
You're being a grown-up. Wow.
I know. Wow. Shit, like this happens once in a blue moon.
It does indeed. And speaking of grown-ups, because since we last had her on Down the Pub, Heather's basically re-landscaped her whole lawn single-handedly. And I mean like her, and that's not code, that her actual lawn.
Yeah, it's, I'm here.
She looks like she's there in body and not at all in mind. Right, okay, so let's get this started then. Oh, it's going to be a nice little compact debate tonight. So we're going to have, I think, because I'm going to do one as well, we're going to have six Germans to choose from. Let's go to, Clive. Should we do Clive first? Because he's basically been waiting since 7 o'clock and it's now 20 past eight. So I feel like he's going to explode.
I'll come gushing out with it. And despite Alex's commandment not to go post-1933, that's where I'm going. There are a couple of very surprising omissions from this evening's debate. Otto von Bismarck, the man who created Germany, and Karl Marx, the German who had the greatest influence of any German on the whole world. While noting their exclusion, I've not chosen either of them, but have gone instead for the man who made modern Germany, Konrad Adenauer. He was the person who said, in view of the fact that God limited the intelligence of man, it seems unfair that he did not also limit its stupidity. Now, Adenauer was a man with many faults, and he faced much criticism during his life and since. As he quipped, a thick hide is a gift from God, and first make yourself unpopular, then you'll be taken seriously. His relationship with the Nazis was not as distant as some might have liked, either during their period in power or his own. He was conservative, he was devoutly Catholic, he created a society that gave rise to dissatisfaction among the youth, the like of which we can only imagine in this country, the moment at least. The Bader-Meinhof gang were part of his legacy. He was criticised for allowing Germany to be divided, and for the social and economic consequence of that division, families torn apart, and for allowing vast swathes of Germany to be swallowed up by Poland as the Soviet Union moved west. But criticism was something that he could accept. Against this, one must recognise his achievements. His policies led to the post-war German economic miracle. I remember my parents being furious when a young German student who was lodging at our house in the early 1960s said, "You may have won the war, but we have won the peace." Within 20 years of the war ending, a war that devastated Germany, killing millions, displacing more, destroying its entire economic infrastructure, West Germany had become a stronger economic force than the United Kingdom, the victor. In so doing, Adenauer laid the groundwork for Kohl, Schmidt and Merkel. He provided the economic strength that allowed reunification. He established Germany as the leading European economic power and the driving force behind the EU. Adenauer was the father of modern Germany in the same way that Bismarck was the father of the bellicose state that started two world wars. Adenauer reinvented Germany. What he left behind was a force for good and not for evil. Konrad Adenauer was born in Cologne in January 1876 into a family of civil servants. He attended the humanist Postel Gymnasium and on leaving school went to work for a bank. His background was unremarkable. And then he got lucky and was awarded a scholarship to study law, a fine training for anyone. He attended the University of Freiburg. After qualifying, he served a short period as a judge and then joined a law firm run by a clone politician from the Centre Party. He married well in 1904 and naturally fell into centre-right politics. In 1906, he was elected alderman and 3 years later became deputy to the mayor, who luckily was his wife's uncle. Luckier still, his role kept him away from the army and he spent the war organising Cologne's food supply. His wife died suddenly in 1916. And he was hospitalised soon afterwards following a car accident. But by 1917, his late wife's uncle moved to Berlin and a cabinet post, and Adenauer stepped into the mayor's office. He was the youngest mayor in Prussia, and he set about his task following the devastation of Germany's defeat with gusto. He aimed to create a metropolis of the West to rival Berlin. In 1919, he founded Cologne University. He held a trade fair, built docks on the Rhine, and took steps at the time not totally popular that ensured that the Rhineland was not annexed by the French. As president of the Prussian Council of State, a position he held from 1921 to 1933, he held considerable influence across the country, but when the Nazis came to power, he was immediately dismissed from all his positions and banned from Cologne. Already 57 years old, he may have thought that the time had come to retire. He kept a low profile. In 1944, after the attempt on Hitler's life, he was imprisoned until the end of the war. 1945, aged 70, he returned to Cologne, where the American occupying forces appointed him as mayor. This didn't last too long, as a few months later, the British, who had taken control of the area, dismissed him and expelled him from Cologne. This, of course, had a profound impact upon him and Germany. Perhaps if he'd been left in Cologne, he might have carried on serving the city. But instead, he formed a new political party, combining Catholic and Protestant conservatives into the Christian Democrats. In 1949, he was elected chancellor of a fledgling German, West German state. He was 73 years old and stayed in that position for the next 14 years. As he once said, when everybody else thinks it's the end, we have to begin. So what did he achieve in those 14 years? He built a new democracy. In foreign policy, he achieved state sovereignty for West Germany. He built close ties to the free West. He reconciled with France and took steps towards European unification. He integrated displaced people and refugees into German society. Here, he was accused of also integrating former Nazis, but that was part and parcel of his policy of bringing Germany together. He achieved the expansion of a social market economy as a new kind of economic order in which the promotion of free competition and the responsibility of the welfare state are interconnected. He was the person behind the German economic miracle. He secured internal social peace. Legislation on determination of the steel and coal industry and on capital formation for employees, burden sharing, social housing construction, child benefit, the green plan for agriculture, dynamically shaping the social security pension became another anchor point of West Germany's renowned welfare system. For the first time in Germany, social policy was continually and consistently pursued as a structural policy. And in doing all of that, he clearly laid the foundations of modern Germany and allowed it to thrive as it has. He stepped down from the chancellorship 2 years after the Berlin Wall was built, but by then he had already set the groundwork that would allow for its destruction and German reunification. Critics believed he should have adopted an Austrian model. Whether this was achievable is debatable. If he had followed that path, Germany and Europe would probably not be as strong as they are today.
Lots of applause for Clive. Well done, because we all joked, didn't we, about let's just pretend German history doesn't exist after 1933. But Clive comes in like a grown-up right at the beginning in Holmes and gives credit where it's due for the man that fixed Germany after all that shit.
Adenauer's not exactly... You know, if I were around in Germany at that time, I almost certainly wouldn't have voted for him. But you have to look back with respect to what he did achieve.
Holmes, what do you make of it?
I mean, I looked at, I'd never heard of him, to be honest, but I looked at him earlier, and actually he's a quite a strong candidate, I think. I mean, despite Clive's efforts with a couple of accents there, I've got a feeling the subject matter tonight isn't exactly going to be a comedy goldmine, to be honest. So we'll just go with what we've got. I think, Clive, you hinted at it a little bit, and that was his relationship, if you like, with the Nazis. I mean, from what I could see, he wasn't a Nazi. He was against them. He was imprisoned, as you mentioned. I think he was imprisoned another time as well.
Yeah.
To power. He sort of brought in an amnesty for the Nazis, didn't he?
Yeah, it was his denazification that raised a lot of acrimony in later times. And also, if you look into the origins of the Baader-Meinhof gang and people like that, there was huge discontentment among the youth, particularly, that the people who were in authority over them were former Nazis and were, you know, authoritarian in their approach to life generally. And that wasn't necessarily such a good thing. But one can understand why Adenauer did it, because he had to try and forge a country together and bring everyone together and to get over that the Nazi period and put it behind them.
Yeah,
we might have a Truth and Reconciliation Council or something like that. I don't think there was the luxury that one could do that with then.
Which I kind of get to a certain degree, but the amnesty applies to everyone, including people in the SS who were known to have done terrible things. And I'm treading carefully because there's obviously someone who knows more about this stuff than me on this podcast. But and also, did he abandon that after a couple of years, though, didn't he? 51?
You're the historian, not me.
Well, I'm a man who had half an hour in his hands to look at Wikipedia beforehand, so I wouldn't go. Okay. No further questions in that case.
Excellent. I'm just playing devil's advocate in that. Kit, you can't even NASA aren't even clean from Nazi taintedness, are they?
I mean, the Americans brought over Wernher von Braun, who was an ardent Nazi. You know, there is a very famous song about him, about how much he doesn't care if it's a V2 rocket or a space probe, as long as he's, you know, blowing something up. Dr. Strangelove was based on Wernher von Braun. So certainly the US were very, very happy to use Nazis. The Russians absolutely were. They captured a load of German scientists and they used them. So this idea that there was this instant denazification that occurred is just a myth. It didn't happen.
Well done, Clive, for taking on a post-World War II German. Let's go to Chris next. Chris, because you are entering, I'm keen, because seeing as you basically love all Germans, are you going to do Victoria Louise? Are you going to do the Kaiser's daughter? Or are you going to pick someone else and be sensible?
I'm going to pick someone else and be sensible. Okay. mainly because I thought someone was going to steal her from me. I'm looking at a picture across my room. How weird is that? and so
weird on many, many levels, Chris.
Yeah. And that's why I'm single. Well, one of the reasons. But before I do my sensible pitch, Sophie was really excited and she wanted to do a pitch, but it's a school night, so she couldn't. So she texted me this morning with Rapunzel is the best German and the best Disney princess. This is because she of her healing power and her independence. She blackmails a stranger into helping her with the one thing she wanted from when she was a young girl. Rapunzel managed to find her birth parents without even knowing she had been taken away from them.
Holmes, what say you about Rapunzel?
I was just saying, is that a Brothers Grimm one? I don't know.
Yeah, Kit's nodding. I'm going to take
Kit. Okay. And that wasn't on the list. But Krista, you didn't mention the long hair, did you? I mean, that's the first thing that comes into anyone's mind about Rapunzel.
It's not really selling his daughter's choice.
I mean, hair so long and so strong that a bloke can climb up it and get into a big tower. That's got to be the first bit, hasn't it?
Also, she's blonde, blue-eyed, relatively tall because she's in a tower. But
I mean, I suppose having hair roots that strong is possibly an Aryan trait, isn't it, I guess? But I don't really know that much about hair and biology and stuff.
No, I don't think they tested for that in the 30s. All right, my serious choice. I've probably got as much chance of winning as Karl von Müller had of winning First World War. So let's start with it. Karl von Müller was born in 1873 in Hanover. His father was a Prussian colonel, and he joined the German Navy, surprise, surprise, in 1891. He served in various vessels. I'm not going to list them. But he was on the unprotected cruiser Schwalbe off Germany, East Africa, when he contracted malaria. He was then, because of his illness, he went back to Germany, where he got moved on to the staff of Prince Heinrich, the Kaiser's brother, where he was later promoted to corvette and captain, moved to the Navy office, where he worked for Admiral von Tirpitz, who was the head of the German Navy at the time, Grand Admiral von Tirpitz, who was head of the Navy, who really liked von Müller. So in the spring of 1913, he's given the command of the light cruiser Emden in the Far East as part of the East Asian Squadron. During the tour of the German possessions, the Emden is fired upon by rebels whilst anchored off Nanjing. So the German cruiser fires back, beats off the rebels, and he is awarded the Order of the Royal Crown, third class. So I hear you all saying, so he's the captain of a boat in the German Navy. Who gives a toss? There's thousands of them. Well, he actually has quite a big impact. In 1914, he suddenly finds himself in a serious dilemma. As the Second Reich only had one major colony in the Far East, in Tsingtao in China, with several other secondary colonies in New Guinea, Samoa, and a scattering of Pacific islands, all under the protection of some German admiral called Vice Admiral von Spee, I may have mentioned him before, and his squadron. As war loomed, looked inevitable, von Müller was the senior naval officer in Tsingtao aboard the Emden. So he has to take over charge of defending the city. He gives orders to the governor and to the other naval personnel to get as many colliers and supply ships to von Spee's armored cruisers, and also to convert the liner Prince Eitel Friedrich into a warship. He then buggers off the Gulf of Korea, and on the first day of the war captures the Russian ship Ryazan, brings it back to Tsingtao, and orders that to be turned into a warship. He later then takes these ships and joins von Spee, where he argues if the squadron is going to head east, that a single German ship should remain in the Indian Ocean and destroy as much British shipping as it possibly can to draw the British away from the squadron. Von Spee gives him the job. He said, fine, if you really want to do it, you do it. And so somewhere between August and November 1914, the Emden captures 22 civilian ships. I'm not going to go into the each and every capture because everyone will get bored. And if you are interested, I might suggest this book by Chris Sams, German Raiders of the First World War. It's still available. You can buy it. And it goes, there's two chapters on this.
But he sounds like a wanker.
He does. What a pillock. He even looks gormless. But the standard method of capture was quite straightforward. They'd sneak up on they had a fake funnel attack that they made to look like a British ship. They'd sneak up on a civilian ship, signal them and say, no wireless, stop your engines. If the ship refused, they would fire a warning shot. They never actually had to fire a damaging shot. Once the ship had been slowed down and stopped, they'd send over a boarding party, take the civilians off the ship, take everything they needed from the ship, and then sink it. And so they had quite a few supplies. The civilians were then placed on what they used to keep one ship with them at all times, that they would then turn into a sort of a floating prison, or a junker, as they used to call them, or junkmen. And the prisoners were kept in really good condition. They were well fed, they were looked after. And when one of these ships got filled to a certain level, von Müller would release them either to a neutral port or at a very slow pace towards the British port, and then leave so that they'd be somewhere else by the time they got to the prisoners. On every occasion that the prison ship was released, the prisoners gave the German crew and their captain three cheers and a thanks for looking after. And in all the news reports, they said what a wonderful, wonderful captor this German ship's captain had been, except for two men. It was one of the captains of one of the ships and his chief engineer, who kept referring to them as blasted Germans, being drunk and disorderly. So von Müller ordered them to be locked into a supply cupboard. And then they were the only people to complain. But everyone else said what a wonderful, wonderful person they were. But it's not just that. Von Müller did three exceptional moves of relativeness. One of them was the 22nd of September. 9:30 at night, Madras Harbour. HMS Hampshire is seen to sail into the port. Half an hour later, HMS Hampshire starts opening fire on the Burma oil supplies. It actually turns out it's the Emden. Within half an hour, they set fire to the oil supplies. They didn't fire on any of the civilian areas. They concentrated just on the oil tanks. Of course, mass panic. Only five people were killed in the bombardment. And that happened. They started sinking a couple of ships in the harbour, and there were some cadets on one of them. They then left, and they went to go and hide on a British island, who had no idea the war was on. They thought the Germans were just there to visit. And the Germans even fixed their motorboat, the island's motorboat, whilst they repaired the ship. The final one was the Battle of Penang on the 28th of October, with the Emden again sneaking into the harbour, sinking the Russian cruiser Zemchug, and then opening fire on some of the ships in harbour, but then having to flee. On the way out, they run into the French destroyer Mosquet, sink it, take all the wounded and survivors on board, then stop a British ship and put the wounded onto them and direct them to the nearest Dutch colony where there's a field hospital. And with it is a letter from Captain von Müller to the governor of Penang, apologising for not stopping to pick up the Zemchug survivors because they believe there are enough Allied ships that could do that, and also for the accidental firing on a civilian launch, which they thought was a destroyer. Emden is then sunk whilst fighting valiantly at the Battle of Cocos against HMAS Sydney. Apparently, my friend who worked at the Australian Imperial War Museum said the Australians won't shut up about it. But this doesn't sound like much. However, von Müller's story was followed by the global press. In Germany, he became an absolute hero. The entire crew were allowed to add von Emden to their names. The ship itself was given the Iron Cross. The German newsreels went nuts for it. The neutral powers did as well. They thought this was fantastic. He didn't kill a single civilian in 4 months' worth of campaign. The British as well had to grudgingly give this man respect. The fact that he'd lived this Robin Hood existence for about three, four months, cruising around the Indian Ocean, embarrassing the Admiralty at every turn, and for carrying out a gentlemanly war. This is in stark contrast of what's going on the Western Front. When we think about the rape of Belgium, the beastly Hun, and what will come later with U-boats, von Müller was a paragon of German nobility and chivalry. And in fact, when the German Navy shelled Scarborough in December of 1914, Punch ran a cartoon of von Müller holding a sheet of paper, looking angry with the words, with the bombardment of Scarborough written across it. And underneath it just said, disgraced. He would go into custody. Then he was shifted to England, where he escaped from a POW camp, quickly recaptured. But his malaria that I mentioned earlier flared up, and eventually he's repatriated to Germany in 1918. He does get involved in politics very, very briefly. He was awarded the Corps Mérite, and he was a member of the German People's Party. But he unfortunately died from his malaria in 1923. So unlike a lot of his contemporaries in the German Navy, he doesn't get tainted by Nazism or involvement in the Kriegsmarine later. So he is a genuine war hero.
Hurrah! Well done, Chris. Totally not surprised at that choice. Holmes, were you?
Well, I was, like you. I thought he'd go for the Kaiserstochter singing. He spent months and months hearing exactly...
I fancy her. The end.
Yeah. I think, to be fair, he's gone further than saying that he just fancies her over the months that we've been doing this. But it's good to see that his broadband seems to be up to about 2 meg now, so that's a welcome improvement.
Yeah, and we bought him a microphone as well, so...
I think this one might be a bit of a stretch. When I had a look earlier, even his Wikipedia page is only about half a page, so he's up against some pretty stiff competition. Rather, I mean, he sounds like I quite like the sort of gentleman aspect of it, but part of me thinks it's quite easy to be that benevolent in the circumstances that he found himself in. You know, in the, you know, if I'd captured 22 unarmed civilian ships, I would probably be able to treat their crew okay. It'd be a different matter if they were all armed and firing back at him. You know, and there's a slight hint at his personality, which, you know, I think, Chris, you said that at one point he'd taken some British people off the ship and they were on one of these sort of prison ships. And the first time two of them criticise him, he locks them in a cupboard. So I don't think he's necessarily as benevolent as you're making out.
I think it was a boarding officer who first suggested that they be incarcerated, that they were being belligerent and unhelpful. So he just said, well, we'll just separate them and we'll put... It was a bit more than a cupboard. It was a storage area for minesweeping equipment. So it wasn't just like a kitchen cupboard or something. So they had a lot of space. They were just separated from everyone else.
I mean, to be fair, there's probably grounds to be belligerent, even if you've not been fired upon. I was on a ferry at the weekend. If another vessel came alongside and made us all get off and put us on a sort of a prison ship for a couple of months, I'd probably be a bit grumpy about it.
Yeah. Especially in the Channel.
And then he didn't kill any civilians, but did he kill sort of naval equivalents?
Well, there were sailors aboard the Zemchug who were killed when she exploded, was torpedoed and sunk, and the same with the Moskoe. The captain had the Frenchman in charge had his legs blown away they were firing back at that point, so it was a proper battle.
And then you mentioned the Madras thing, but I didn't really capture that. I took that slightly personally because my great granddad was an engineer for the Burma Oil Company.
Oh, there was actually something else about that. The people, because it was quite an embarrassment to the British government, because the governor was one of the 300 people who fled and he didn't come back for several days. And a lot of the people lost a lot of respect for him. And I did read somewhere that the word Mdina stuck into local dialects to mean cunning. And mothers would tell their children that if they didn't behave, the Mdin would come back and get them. I don't know if that makes any difference.
And also, it's interesting because they were based at Tsing Tao, weren't they?
Yeah, when they're at the beginning of the war.
Because the German influence there, that's where the beer comes from, isn't it? Because there were breweries established by Germans when they were there, which led to the beer we know today.
Yeah, it has the same German purity law for only four ingredients.
Nothing further from me.
Brilliant. Let's do one more and then we'll break to get some more drinks. Let's do Alina. Let's have a girl next. Alina.
A girl. Cheers for that one.
Well.
I'm just looking for my...
Use the term loosely.
Oh, thanks. You know, we can double check that if you like, but no thanks. Anyway.
Was it like, yes, please?
So I got really, really annoyed when I found out about this, that I'd actually have to go and do some research about someone. And I'm just going to tell you a very brief introduction to how I got around to this. And Chris and I sat talking about this for a really long time, what I should do, who I should do. Then I thought I'd be really, really funny and do a historian like Katia Hoyer because she's so frigging awesome and love her to pieces. And then I kind of thought I should be a little bit serious occasionally. And then I thought I'd be really more funny by finding a German who has Polish roots and kind of piss everyone off while doing that. And then I kind of thought maybe not, because that becomes too complicated. Thought I might do a footballer. Then I kind of thought, no, I don't want to piss Alex off because I'm terrified of getting some football term wrong or something else. So instead, I settled on something to really piss Alex off by far and to annoy her beyond anything she could possibly be annoyed by. And what is the one thing that I'm not allowed to talk about on this podcast thing consistently? And that is not Hindenburg. Thank you, Kit. I'm not allowed to talk about the Holocaust. And what am I going to do today? I'm actually going to talk about someone who I think, for me personally, I don't care about winning, by the way. Really don't care about that today. But I care about talking about this person because he is so beyond incredible. And he is I think I've mentioned him on the podcast before. I must have mentioned him on the podcast before, and I'm absolutely obsessed with this guy. He is an angel in a place of absolute horror and absolute... Oh, Alex has come back. Should I tell her again? Should I repeat again what I'm doing?
Like, I go for a pee and she invokes the Holocaust. Is that what's happened?
Yes.
Oh, Christ. Go on, just get on with it. Well,
because I was going to either piss you off with football that I was going to do errors and that might really infuriate you, or the Holocaust. So take your pick.
Oh, just do the Holocaust. Get it out of the way. Come
on. Yeah, I thought so. Anyway, so this guy, for me, he is probably one of the most incredible human beings ever to walk this earth, especially in a place of fear and pain and horror. This guy comes out with the most amazing things he could possibly do. And I'm going to talk about Otto Kuzel. And Holmes, you can start Googling Kuzel. There's not much on him, but I'm still going to tell you.
Sorry, I can't even. Can you say his name again a bit slower?
Otto Kuzel. But anyway, moving on. He's actually born in 1909. He's born in Berlin, and he ends up being arrested in 1937, and he gets put into KL Sachsenhausen, which is just north of Berlin. He's done for something really petty, like theft, and he's just imprisoned for that. He's imprisoned on a green triangle, so he's classified as a German criminal. So when Auschwitz starts kicking off in 1940, the first prisoners that arrive there are 30 criminals from Sachsenhausen, and Otto Kuzel is on that transport. He's given prisoner number two. And when the first mass transport actually arrives to the camp, the German prisoners are told that they are rapists and murderers and like the most horrible human beings that could ever walk this earth. Yet Otto Kuzel shows kindness to these people when they arrive, while others are beating them and kicking the shit out of them and screaming at them and everything else. Otto Kuzel stands by the door into the Monopoly building where they arrive to, and he hands out people water. And he walks up to one of the prisoners, Roman Trajanovsky, and he says, don't worry, holds his hand, he says, don't worry, this will be over soon. You will be safe, you will be okay. And he shows these incredible acts of kindness while everybody else is literally screaming their heads off and beating people and just causing fear to run rampant. And Otto Kuzel just shows this beautiful kindness. So we're moving on further into the concentration camp system and things. He actually ends up being the prisoner who takes care of job assignments. And what he actually does is, this is my personal opinion, and actually not just my personal opinion, but a lot of my historian friends agree with me, is that he managed to save a lot of lives. And you're thinking, how is this guy saving lives in this context? What he does is he takes prisoners from some of the most horrific work details and starts moving them around. So, for example, Zbigniew Terecki, is a prime example, his brother got kicked the shit out of so severely, he ended up in hospital. Now, if he went out, for example, in the middle of winter, still half broken, to go and work, I don't know, for example, in the building detail, he's going to be dead in literally days or hours. So Otto Kuzel manages to sort him out a job still in the hospital to sweep floors and clean and do the basic things. So he would do this. He would move the prisoners who are most at risk around the prison, around the camp. The other thing is that there's not one word that me nor any historian I know has ever found anything negative said about this man. It is all completely positive. There's another example. Otto Kuzel would be the type of man who would walk down, for example, the road in the concentration camp, and he'd come across a prisoner with a torn shirt, torn trousers, completely destroyed boots. And he would literally give the shirt off of his back to these people. He would then be able to himself go back to the Effektenkammer, so basically the place where you would be able to get clothing and get new clothing for himself. Another example, Christmas comes along. All the capos, so the functionary prisoners, they all get a big box of, you know, sausages and chocolate and all of these things that you can't get hold of. All the other capo are just kind of shushing people away. He stands in the middle of the camp surrounded by all of these prisoners and he says, wait a minute. And he hands out every single thing he has. He did everything and anything he could help. Not just this, he actually ends up escaping with three other Poles. It is one of my favorite, I'm not going to go through this whole escape, but it is one of my favorite escapes of all time. What they do is they literally drive a horse and carriage out of the camp. And that's what they do. They manage to escape. Otto Kuzel ends up in Warsaw. He's escaped for about 9 months, 9-10 months. He gets captured again, gets taken back into the into Auschwitz, gets put into Block 11. But because he's German, he doesn't get executed. not important what happens to the other prisoners. One survives, two die, just in case anybody wants to know. And if anybody really wants to know about the story, just DM me and I'll tell you the whole story. But Jan Komski, actually, if anybody knows Jan Komski, Google him. He'll also be able to tell you the whole history of that escape. It's a really good one. So he is end up in Auschwitz. Then what they do is they release him from Block 11. And Heather, Jan Komski, very easy. J-A-N Komski, K-O-M-S-K-I, Komski. There you go. Just in case. And so they release him and they send him to Konzentrationslager, so KO Flossenburg. And that's where he is released. He ends up standing trial as a witness in a few trials. And it's actually really horrible the way they portray him and the way they speak to him during the trial, as if he is one of the people that basically committed all of these atrocities. But there is no evidence, zero evidence, Otto Kuzel even raised his hand to any prisoner. And to me, he is the most amazing, kindest person in such a horrific, disgusting place. So thank you.
Holmes.
A couple of questions. I don't know if you mentioned it at the start. I heard you say that he was prisoner number two at Auschwitz. Does that mean, was he taken there because he was Jewish, or was he taken there as a political prisoner?
He was a criminal.
Criminal, okay. And then presumably that meant he, was he a capo as well?
Yeah, functionary prisoner. First 30 were all functionary prisoners.
And if he, because quite a lot, most of the capos were terrible, weren't they, in terms of?
Capos are a very, again, we don't have the time in the world, but it's a very black and white scenario. You had a lot of capos. It did bring out the most sadistic bastards. I have a capo in my own research who's a Pole, and his favourite thing was to beat Poles. I mean, I don't know how you could imagine doing that. There were also Jewish capos, Polish, loads, but not everybody was bad and not everybody was good. It's really grey and it's a really difficult moment, because there are a lot of factors that come into this, and that's why a lot of historians don't write about capos, because it is not that black and white, not good and not evil.
Okay, and then where you mentioned that he saved people by putting on different work details and stuff, presumably that was, if people cottoned on to what he was doing, he was at risk then, yeah? And then he mentioned that he escaped, and then he came back, and he was put in Block 11. Block 11's the torture block, isn't it? So it's not
prison
very,
within a prison, yeah.
Not very pleasant. Okay, no, he's a good candidate. I haven't got any more questions.
Okay, we're back, and we have three more to come. I'm going to go with someone who has some German ancestry. I'm going to go with Heather.
I always get that slight panic when you say that. Okay, so I'm going to do Marlene Dietrich. Basically, she was born in Schoenberg, which is now a district of Berlin. Her mom was from an affluent family, and her dad was a police lieutenant who ended up dying before World War I. Her mom ended up marrying her dad's best friend, and then he died 2 years later from injuries in the First World War. Beyond that, her childhood was actually fairly normal. She went to school, dreamed of being a concert violinist. She ended up starting her career as a chorus girl because she had a wrist injury that kind of killed the concert violinist dream. She ended up getting a small part in the film Little Napoleon in 1923. And that opened up a lot of acting for the stage and started leading to more sizable parts in movies. She ended up marrying in Berlin in 1923. And then in 1930 had her big breakthrough with The Blue Angel. The director encouraged her to move to California and helped promote her in Hollywood, where she worked steadily through the 1930s and ended up being one of the best paid film stars until in the late 30s, when her star began to fade a little bit and she wasn't as largely in the public eye as she had been. But she still made films and did travels to promote the films. And during some of these travels, she was actually approached by the Nazi Party to return to Germany and star in movies for them. They put very lucrative offers in front of her, you know, said she was a German. That was, you know, please come do this for us. And she said no. and as pretty much a wife yourself to the Nazis. She applied for citizenship in the U.S. in 1937. So she had always had very strong political opinions, definitely was not afraid to voice them. In the late 1930s, she helped create a fund with Billy Wilder and other German exiles to help Jews and other dissidents, like the gays and lesbians of Germany and, you know, the others that might pretty much die if they stay there, helped get them out of Germany. One of her highest paid movies was Night Without Armor, in which she made $450,000 at the time. So lots and lots of money now for some people. She put the whole amount into that fund to help save people from the Nazis in Germany. In 1939, she became a U.S. citizen and renounced her German citizenship. And when the U.S. entered the Second World War in 1941, she was one of the first public figures to sell war bonds and was said to have sold more than any other star. She toured with the USO from January 1942 to September 1943, and she appeared before 250,000 troops on just the Pacific leg of her tour alone. That was not the only time she toured with the USO. She did two more times, so in 1944 and 45, where she performed for Allied troops in Algeria, Italy, France, the UK, and the Netherlands. And she also entered Germany with the US generals Gavin and Patton. She was one of the stars who helped the OSS, precursor to the CIA, record a number of songs and basically anti-war propaganda or anti-German propaganda, which were used against the Nazis. She was the only person helping out that actually knew what they were going for. And she was more than happy to help out. She was actually very popular with both sides, even in the songs against the Germans. Some of them really liked her voice and everything. After the war in 1947, she received the Medal of Freedom from the U.S. for quote, her extraordinary record entertaining troops overseas during the war. She received the, I'm probably going to butcher this, so I'm sorry, the Legion d'Honneur from the French government for her wartime work. And in 1965, she received the Israeli Medallion of Valor for, quote, in recognition for her courageous adherence to principle and consistent record of friendship for the Jewish people, end quote. So after the war, she continued to act in movies and was a staple on stage till around 75, when a onstage injury ended her career. But given that she had always been really influential in the politics, she actually had the telephone numbers of more than a few world leaders. She would call Ronald Reagan, Mikhail Gorbachev, and Margaret Thatcher frequently on the phone to discuss politics, to the point where one of her monthly phone bills was $3,000. A lot of phone conversations, because I can't even imagine having a bill that high. So she passed away in Paris at age 90, and her funeral saw scores of people, like thousands and thousands. There were ambassadors from Germany, Russia, the US, and the UK, and a bunch of other countries. The medals she received for her war work were displayed at the foot of her coffin, military style, with the officiant priest remarking, quote, everybody knew her life as an artist of film and song, and everyone knew her tough stance. She lived like a soldier and would like to be buried like a soldier. She was buried in a cemetery in Schoenberg, near where her mom was buried, per her wishes. So given the fact that she really tried to take down the Nazis and had such strong feelings of equality and that the Nazis were horrible, horrible people. So that's why she's my pick for greatest German.
Well done, Heather. I really like that one, Holmes.
I'm not sure about this one. I mean, she's undoubtedly a very impressive person. I was surprised to mention her, who her lovers included. When I looked at her, it includes Errol Flynn, George Bernard Shaw, John F. Kennedy, John Wayne, Kirk Douglas, to name a few. Quite an impressive bunch.
But definitely impressive. But I wanted to kind of picture more of the fact that she wasn't just about sex. She was about, you know, caring for humanity.
And she certainly did do that. I guess my seeing as we're being asked to consider history's greatest German, my sort of issue is that she doesn't really feel German to me. She wasn't there very much. It's a bit like me nominating myself for the greatest living Manc or Derby fan. You know, it's just tiny little bits of my past that are really relevant. And also,
she started there. That's what accounted for me.
She did. And then she went back there in the 60s and got quite a hostile reception, apparently.
Yes.
To the point it made her a little bit ill and she vowed never to go back again.
Yes. It seemed like one half of Germany was totally like, hey, this is great. We like her. And the other half was like, get out. You're not German. You're a traitor. And I can understand her kind of being like, okay. But at the same time, good for her for standing up for her principles.
And then do we know if her reputation was rehabilitated over the years? Since then, is she looked at more favorably in Germany now?
Honestly, I'm not sure.
And then I thought it was interesting that, yeah, as you mentioned, that in her later years, she used to ring up Reagan, Thatcher, Gorbachev. I mean, my mum is quite old. She'll just fucking speak to anyone on the phone all day. So I don't know if there's an element of that or not. But okay. No, nothing further.
Okay. Well done, Heather. I'm glad we've got a woman in the mix now as well that isn't Princess Victoria Louise. Kit. Kit's just going to bring someone now that changes the face of humanity and makes us all look like dicks, aren't you?
I am. That's how I roll. That's
why no one likes you.
Yeah, I'm going to bring together someone who, I mean, I'm going to stay in my lane, obviously. I'm going to choose a scientist. And the biggest pitch problem I've got is, which scientist do I pick from Germany? I mean, Albert Einstein was born in Ulm. The problem is Albert Einstein was a truly terrible human being. He was horrible to his wife, and he did his best to distance himself from Germany as soon as he could. So you've also got Johannes Kepler, who was born in Ulm as well, fantastic scientist. You've got element discoverers like Hennig Brand, the German who discovered phosphorus while trying to turn his own piss into gold. You've got Max Planck, you've got Rudolf Diesel, you've got Nicholas Otto, you've got the infamous Fritz Haber, who on the one hand saved billions through his process of producing fertilizers, and on the other was the father of chemical weapons. So I'm going to avoid all of that, and I've gone for a physicist that you might not have heard of, but has absolutely saved your life, and that is Wilhelm Röntgen. And Röntgen was born in 1845 in Wuppertal in the Rhineland, and was thrown out of school for drawing cartoons of his teachers, which, in fact, he hadn't done. It was another pupil who had handed it to him. Instead, he ended up as a mechanical engineer. And in the 1890s, he began to experiment with cathode ray tubes and electrostatic charge. Now, this all sounds a bit scientific, so let's simplify it. Röntgen noticed that he was causing mysterious rays. He didn't know what they were. They were something unknown to science. And so he began to investigate. He worked around the clock. He ate and slept in his lab as he investigated this unknown phenomenon. And in 1895, he found the answer. He was making something that no one had discovered before. Unable to come up with a good name, he decided simply to call this mysterious discovery the X-ray. A month later, he decided that he needed proof of his concept, and working out that he could take radiographs with these rays, he decided to photograph his wife Anna's hand. He produced a perfect reproduction of the skeleton inside her flesh, claiming, you know, Anna shouted out to the world, I have seen my death. In late 1895, Röntgen published his paper. It would go on to be the most life-saving in history, the discovery of unknown rays. X-rays have now become a cornerstone of science and engineering, and most importantly, medicine, where they give doctors unique insight into what's going on inside of you. During World War I, Marie Curie operated mobile X-ray theatres to treat servicemen. And X-rays are now so simple, it's been seen everywhere from doctors to dentist chairs. It is so important to the history of humanity that in 1901, Wilhelm Röntgen became the first ever recipient of the Nobel Prize. But Röntgen never courted fame. Offered a title by the Kaiser, the chance to become von, he turned it down. Offered millions, he took the money and gave it to charity. Offered a chance to patent his rays, he refused, instead allowing them to be used by millions around the world. During the hyperinflation after World War I in the 1920s in the Weimar Republic, he lost all of his money. He became bankrupt, dying of cancer in 1923. He could have gone to the US, but he never did. He stayed in Munich, a loyal German to the end. Even so, he continues to be honored for his work, which indisputably changed our world for the better. There is a peak in Antarctica named after him, and an asteroid, and perhaps the greatest honor of all, element 111 bears his name, Röntgenium. He is now synonymous with one of the very building blocks of our universe.
You wanker. You completely pissed all over mine just before I've done it. But is yours a Christmas tree
ornament? Oh, sorry, did you pick X-rays as well?
No, but is yours a Christmas tree ornament?
He is not a Christmas tree ornament, as far as I'm aware. If anyone has got a Wilhelm Röntgen Christmas ornament, I would love to own it. Please, send it to me.
Holmes, this is a bloody good shout, isn't it?
It is. It was very good. It was looking quite good for Clive until then, without giving too much away. But no, it's good. I haven't really got any questions. But the one thing that I always thought, and we were always told, like Marie Curie invented X-rays. Is that it, or is that something different, or is it a different application? Or
it's slightly different. So Marie Curie discovered essentially radioactivity. That was her big thing, and she studied under Henri Becquerel in France with her husband Pierre Curie. And she was one of the pioneers of radiation. In fact, she came up with the term radioactivity. X-rays, something slightly different. It is a related field. As I mentioned, Marie Curie and her daughter Irene actually operated mobile X-ray theatres during the First World War, but it isn't the same.
Right, okay, brilliant shout from Kit. I've kind of given you a spoiler on mine. Here is my Christmas ornament, which obviously none of you can see because this is radio. I am going to basically piss off all of our Napoleonic friends. I want you to picture this Hollywood historical epic style. I want you to picture a grizzled old man on a horse in the pissing rain, sideways rain, sky's grey, he's soaked to the skin, and soon he's going to win the Battle of Waterloo. And his name is not Arthur Wellesley. His name is Gerhard Leberecht von Blücher. And on the eve of Waterloo, he's nearly 73 years old. Clive, how old are you?
Not yet 65.
There we go. So he's a lot older than Clive, who is the most mature of all of our History Hack participants, which in the early 1800s, let's face it, 73 is a bit miraculous without antibiotics, a winter fuel allowance or Viagra. His life is a Hollywood biopic waiting to happen. Like all action heroes, his beginnings are sad and humble. Picture him scampering around Rostock, which is somewhere in Germany, and then joining the Swedish army as a stringy adolescent, presumably trying to escape a life of drudgery in a sausage factory or a brewery and making his escape into the cavalry. I am miming this with the Christmas tree ornament. I wish you all could see it. At 18, he's down on his luck. Captured by the Prussians in 1760 in Pomerania, I am led to believe reliably by a battalion of poofy little yappy dogs. When plot twist, he changes sides after an existential montage to 80s rock music in which he wrestles with his decision and decides that being Prussian is better than a prison cell. the die was cast. Well, for a few years, because then he reaches that point in the story where you think he's done, because he had a row with Frederick the Great and had to resign for being insubordinate. So cue the part in the film where he becomes a farmer, drinks a lot of schnapps, smashes some things up, and grows a big beard for 13 years until Frederick dies, and he gets his job back. It was an old, if this was an old school Lawrence of Arabia epic, this is where the interval would be, because then it's all upward momentum. As he gets successively promoted for bashing the French, you're thinking, this guy has arrived. But no, there's more adversity to come. By 1806, he was commanding the cavalry corps when he took a complete beating from Napoleon and then had a complete breakdown, which I only found out about half an hour ago from Kit, in which he thought he was giving birth to an elephant, which is going to make for another very trippy montage, because then my brain started wondering to where is the elephant trying to get out of? And then I didn't want to picture that. So I moved on. So how do you come back from this? You boot the French out of Paris, boot Napoleon off his throne and march into the French capital. That's how. And by 1814, he's done this and he should have the credit for that. If Napoleon has got nothing nice to say about you, then as far as I'm concerned, you're winning. So Napoleon said he had no talent for a general. Enough talent to beat you, Boney. But he admired his attitude to be like a bull that looks all around him with rolling eyes. And when he sees danger, charges. Napoleon said he was stubborn and untiring and knew no fear. He called him an old rascal that attacked him with the same fury after the most terrible beating, as he would be on his feet again the next moment and ready for the fight. And fight he did during the Waterloo campaign. In a precursor to the main battle at Ligny, he spent hours lying under his dead horse and survived being repeatedly rode over by the cavalry. Don't forget, he's almost 73. Was he done? No. He gets up, he bathes his wounds in a tantalising mix of garlic and rhubarb, drunk a lot more schnapps, he really did drink the schnapps this time, and resumed command in time for the 18th of June 1815. Blücher is the commander you want. He's not miserable like Boney, who's sulking his way around the battlefield, or detached like Wellington. This is a quote as he made to bail out the British. "Forwards, I hear you say it is impossible, but it has to be done. I have given my promise to Wellington, and you surely don't want me to break it. Push yourselves, my children, and we'll have victory." And without him, the Duke of Wellington would not be getting all the credit for Waterloo. In short, the coalition force was utterly buggered until Blücher came and saved the day. I quote, "With the battle hanging in the balance, Blücher's army intervened with decisive and crushing effect, his vanguard drawing off Napoleon's badly needed reserves and his main body being instrumental in crushing French resistance. The victory led the way to a decisive victory through the relentless pursuit of the French by the Prussians. The two coalition armies entered Paris on the 7th of July." So, because he was as old as dirt and not dead, because he triumphed over adversity a lot, because he made more managerial comebacks than Jose Mourinho, and because he is the true victor in Britain's greatest ever battlefield victory, and because it will piss Marcus off, vote Blücher as the greatest German in history. So there.
It's a very strong one. I like the fact you've got a Christmas ornament of it. Maybe a future subject should be the best depiction of a historical character in a Christmas ornament, because I've got a King Harold from the Bio Tapestry Christmas ornament as well. So there's a few out there.
This is literally the only fucking Blücher souvenir you can buy anywhere at Waterloo, because did you know that the 1815 memorial was run by French contractors? We walked in there with a 9-year-old American a few weeks ago who said, if you didn't know the result of this battle, you'd think Napoleon had won, because everything apart from one T-shirt and one really crummy fridge magnet of Wellington is Napoleon. There is nothing of Blücher. This I got at the Musée de Wellington, and this was all there was. And it's quite a crappy Christmas ornament. But nonetheless, we hung it on the rearview mirror and took Blücher all over the battlefield just to prove a point. So, yeah, this is it. This sad little Christmas ornament is the only present he has on the battlefield.
Not just there, but in ABBA's song Waterloo, there is not one mention of Blücher, which is an abomination.
Rage. Look at him. He's raging. Rage.
I'm not an expert, and I don't want to wind up those that aren't here, but I mean, we wouldn't have won without him and his troops, would we?
No, not according to the mini film in the visitors' centre at the 1815 memorial. I get a bit tearful when Blücher marches up with his or rides up with his, and at the end when he goes and he just shakes hands with or salutes Wellington and then rides off again as if to say, "You're welcome, asshole."
Has he not got any young daughters that Chris has got a bit of a thing for?
Probably great granddaughters by the time Waterloo comes around. Bless him. I still can't, admittedly, I haven't dug any deeper than Wikipedia because I literally put that pitch together in the last 20 minutes. But I can't figure out why he was in the Swedish army other than he lived quite near Sweden. Maybe it was closer than the recruitment office for the Prussians. Who knows?
It makes, because
he's not,
it makes Abba's mission even the greater.
Yeah, exactly. Well, he's not, he's German, but he's not Prussian, but he leads the Prussian. So, yeah. He's from a Grand Duchy of Mecklenburg, something or other unpronounceable. So he's very much German, but for some reason pretends to be Swedish for about 3 years in his teens. Maybe it's that rebellion phase.
Could be.
We've all had the Swedish phase.
Oh, that could mean so many different things. Right, okay, Holmes, have a little think about it. We will go around the room and see who everyone would have voted for if they can't have their own. I think I would have voted for Clive's one. Clive, what about you?
I think I'd go with Marlene Dietrich just because it was Heather who gave the presentation.
Yeah. And it was done with love. Heather, what about you?
I don't know. Believe it or not, I'm not hard to see, but I'm very indecisive. It was a tough one. I don't pick favorites here. I'm not putting my Christmas present in jeopardy.
Alina, what about you?
I don't really like Heather's one, actually. I thought she was pretty cool. I'd like to go out for a drink with her.
Me too.
Oh, which leaves us with Kit.
Adna, I thought Clive really gave a convincing argument for someone who helped unify Germany and made it what it is today.
Yeah. I think there's a big case to be made for the poor bastard that came in and tried to sort all that out after the Second World War. Chris has his German admiral's hat on. His World War One before he starts getting help, hate mail. We were very specific. Chris, what about you?
My first essay for GCSE English, GCSE history, was in the module 18 to 15 to 51. In my first line, I got told off because my teacher said, there is no way that you can get away with saying that the Germans won the Battle of Waterloo. I'd also like to quote one of my best friends, Sam Jolly, who said, Blücher is the coolest German of all time because he's the only person who could beat my beloved Napoleon. So, I mean, it has to be Blücher. I mean, he's a German military hero. I mean, I know von Müller is a naval military hero, but let's face it, Blücher did everything. And he's got two warships named after him.
Yay!
He's one of which turned upside down and sunk in the bottle of Dogger Bank.
And the other one got sunk really quickly in the ocean of Norway.
We don't talk about that one.
Or the other one.
Holmes, which way are you going?
Well, I mean, they were all pretty much neck and neck. Until Kit went, I had Clive winning with the rest all pretty much neck and neck, as I said. But I think it has to be Kit, just because the economic miracle of Germany was very important, but just the benefit of what Rotgen discovered, if I mispronounce that, what he discovered, the benefits that the whole world has illustrated, is probably makes him slightly shaded.
Excellent. So Kit first, Clive second.
Yeah.
And Blücher third, right?
I think we can go, everyone else can go equal third. There's no losers. No losers in this. I've gone woke.
I'm woke. Right. Okay. Thank you very much for joining us. Next time we will not be letting Chris pick the topic because otherwise we'll be having a debate on everybody's favourite German princesses, which could get dull very
quickly. Greatest Pole! Greatest Pole!
Oh God, no, because there's no chance you won't mention the feckin' Holocaust then.
No. I could be a judge. Then I don't have to argue shit.
Yeah, but then I'd be arguing for you, so.
Yeah, we're not doing greatest ever poll. We've done Brits and we've done Germans. Maybe we'll do something ironic next time. Maybe we'll do greatest ever French person and punk Sam, because we all know she'll do Napoleon, and we'll just conspire to make him finish last.
You know what? We should do something like greatest ever Mongol or greatest ever Sudanese and actually make people do some research for a change.
All right.
Greatest ever Belgium.
History's greatest African. That's the next topic. And they're not allowed to be a colonial.
I was going to say, and you can't do Mandela because that just...
Well, come on.
I'll let you fucking argue that out. We will do history's greatest African. They can be white or they can be black, but they must not be like a fucking governor of someone appointed by the British or something like that. They actually have to
couldn't
be...
we invite Marcus back to do Cecil Rhodes?
Do you know what I love? Do you know what I just say? I have to applaud Westminster Abbey for the way they've dealt with Statuegate and the fact that they have statues and memorials to racists and colonisers all over their building, because they've passively aggressively just shaded them out. So when you go into Westminster Abbey now, there's this monstrous East India Company memorial on your right, and they now use that to stack chairs in front of so you can't see it. And if you go find Cecil Rhodes in Westminster Abbey, he's literally in a grotty little corner above a fire hydrant. It's fantastic the way that they've passively aggressively edged these people out of your consciousness. I think that's how it should be done.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.